Stephen Dorrell. I'm now retired, but busier than ever. Essentially, I'm a former academic, journalist, researcher. I've been a consultant to lots of TV programs about intelligence, spies, etc., and British scandals. And I research British intelligence. Nowadays, mostly MI6. And I use what's in the public domain. And my research is centered on building up files and files of material that is available, but people don't bother to look at. And I think you can find out basically what went on in the world if you do that.
I mean, surely all the juicy stories come from actual, like, retired and going and getting intelligence officers and ex-intelligence drunk.
Some do, yes. And I've spoken to a lot, particularly during COVID, which was very good for somebody like me who spent his time talking to these people. But there is a fundamental problem with doing this kind of research in the UK, in that this is a very secretive country, and it's ingrained. And you talk to, like, families of MI6 officers about what their parents did, and some know, and some know in great detail, but many don't know anything at all about what they did, and that's because of this culture of secrecy that people grow up in. And you still get people who just won't talk, and they go to their grave with stories about what went on. And I think that's ridiculous in a way, in that this is part of our history, and events that took place, what, 50 years ago or more, there is no reason to keep them secret anymore, except embarrassment, I think. And there's a lot of that around. There's also a thing about the British that, particularly amongst the kind of media, cultural elite, historians or whatever, and even people who work in this very small field of intelligence studies, that they can't take seriously some of the history of this country. They pass it off as a kind of joke, and they find it kind of funny. They're embarrassed by it. And you see this on TV programs. In the last decade, there have been series about the Profumo Affair, Jeremy Thorpe, etc. And they're not really serious. If anything crops up that is slightly conspiratorial or dangerous or exposes something that was wrong, it's kind of passed off as a joke. And I see this all the time. You go to conferences and you read what people write, and they don't want to consider that perhaps our history isn't like the official version.
Well, no, I totally agree. Having looked into some of the things to do with Second World War, you have an official history, and there are some, all sorts of very interesting accounts peripheral to the war, which the Foreign Office people just simply they just dismiss it immediately, just bat it away. But look, we had a really good discussion last week about the ousting of Harold Wilson. I mean, people still talk about this as he resigning due to ill health. And you did a book, Smear, about this with Robert Ramsey. Yes. So can you just, for those people who probably weren't around in those days, explain why you think it was important, why it was worth doing a book about?
Well, I think it's interesting in retrospect, of course, that Wilson is still highly regarded, although not at the time so much, which is part of the way that the political landscape has changed. I mean, Wilson in the 70s was a kind of centrist, you might say, left of centre. Now he'd be regarded as a radical. But there were sections of the British state in the 60s and 70s who did regard him as a radical. Wilson was incredibly clever. He was somebody who knew a lot about what was going on in terms of the economy, etc. And he had with him a great cabinet in lots of senses. Whatever your views of politics, you know, there were half a dozen people around Wilson, Crossman, Croslands, Callaghan, Jenkins, Healy, who all could have been prime ministers, leaders of the party. There was a lot of kind of internal dissent, plotting, etc. But besides that, there was plotting outside of it because of his politics, because it was a semi-socialist government, and there were people who wanted to bring it down. And there's the allegation of the MI5 plots, which largely came from Peter Wright and Spycatcher. But this is, again, is kind of, this has been used to say that nothing went on. MI5's official view of this is that they were not engaged in any kind of plotting against Wilson, which in one sense is true, because the plot wasn't an MI5 plot. David Stirling, who founded the SAS and was involved with what was going on in the mid-70s, said when he died that in terms of this and his involvement, he said, what you have to remember is that this was a group of people who included members of MI5, somebody like Peter Wright, former members of MI5, and members of MI6 and former members of MI6. And this group came together and launched smear campaigns. They launched kind of what's known as disruptive actions, which was designed to undermine Wilson and the Labour government of the mid-70s.
Now, look, I know you mentioned him being a radical, and immediately I'm thinking about Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, would you compare what was going on then maybe to, I don't want to interrupt your flow, but some of the attacks on Corbyn, you know, smearing him as a terrorist, as was done just a few days before the 2017 general election?
I don't see that they're the same. I think the attacks on Corbyn were obvious and inevitable. He was just the wrong person. Why anybody would have a leader who's so obviously going to come under attack by the conservative press, etc., I thought was ridiculous. And I was not surprised by anything that happened. He was just the wrong person.
But this is the membership, isn't it, that voted for him?
Yeah, and you can vote for anybody you like, but it was obvious from the beginning what would happen. He wasn't going to win. I didn't know him personally, but I certainly knew of Corbyn in the 70s and 80s, and the idea that he would lead the Labour Party and win an election, I thought, was mad.
But he actually came quite close to it, didn't he? He didn't do badly.
He didn't do badly, but he lost. You know, the difference is Wilson won four elections. You know, he's the only person to do that. Four elections is remarkable. People on the left, like myself, were disillusioned in the 70s from the late 60s and 70s because of things like America and Vietnam War. And they didn't pursue a more radical policy, but actually they did achieve a lot. Now, one of the reasons why the right went after Wilson was because, and you can see this from a detailed reading of the right wing of the Tory party, etc., and the people that got involved in this kind of plotting, was basically because the trade unions had some power. And that working class people actually did pretty well in the 70s in terms of wages. And it's certainly true that, in fact, like in America, the working class has never actually got back to the standard of wages that they had in the 70s. And we haven't really. You know, I came from a working class family, and my father did well in the 70s. He got a good wage and he got a good pension. In fact, when he died, I said to him, and I was a university lecturer, and I said, "Dad, I've seen your pension. It is better than mine." So there was an attack, basically came from things that happened in the 60s where trade unions became more powerful and more involved in government. And there were people on the right who really disliked this and thought that this was kind of the end of their economic model, and they had to oppose it. And they did.
There were shots across the bows, weren't there, in previous Wilson governments in the 1960s too.
Yes.
But maybe you could talk a little bit about this group, Stirling, you know, and who were these people? And, I mean, I think you've explained pretty much what motivated them, but you might want to say something about that as well. But who were they?
Well, there was – this is another case, again, where a lot of this stuff is in the public domain, but historians, academics refuse to kind of confront it. I was consultant to a program about this, and I said, you need to talk to Lord Hunt, who was the cabinet secretary under Wilson. And he carried out, when Wilson resigned at the bequest of Callaghan, an inquiry into what had happened. And he produced a report which said there had been plotting. And this is coming from a cabinet secretary. So when a cabinet secretary says something, you have to take it seriously, or you should take it seriously. And he said there were principally two people who were running this. One was the person we know, Peter Wright in MI5. And he said that there were a group of MI5 officers who were basically mavericks out of control, and they were running stories against Wilson. The other one was George Kennedy Young, who was former deputy chief of MI6 in the 50s. He resigned in 62. And in my opinion, was the most important intelligence officer post-war in Britain. And he had, well, it started off in the 1930s and 40s as a left-wing journalist, but by the 50s, he turned to the right, principally under the influence, I think, of his wife, who was a Dutch and an anti-Semitic. And he, in the 60s, decided he wanted to build up a political base, which he started in the Monday Club, attempted to take that over, and through that process met other people on the right.
A group of Tory MPs, yeah?
The Monday Club was right-wing Tory MPs based essentially on support of South Africa, Rhodesia, and they were mostly Powellites, supporters of Enoch Powell. And Young got involved in that and set up various committees, anti-immigration committees, and he put together a group of people who were anti-Labour, anti-Wilson, pro-immigration, and they started to organise. And Young had been mostly responsible for the coup against Iran in 1953. It was his control of the various assets that had actually caused that to win in the end, when the Americans wavered and he forced it through. And he used essentially, as far as I can see, the same techniques, which is what you do is you build up action committees. That was his favourite word, action. These are small little propaganda committees, and he did this in the UK. There were mostly people on the extreme right. You publicise various things, you put in smears, you attempt to undermine what's going on. Young would eventually be the person who really led to this whole thing about paedophiles, that he thought the British establishment was corrupt. That meant not only Wilson, but Heath. And the first part of this was to undermine Heath. And Young was part of Tory Action. He set it up, which was to promote Mrs. Thatcher in the constituencies, with Airey Neave and one or two others. He was very active. He had the support of some intelligence people, and he worked with Peter Wright, and they brought together a group of people in about 73, 74, who began to organize these campaigns. And they had access to intelligence material about alleged communist links of Labour ministers, supporters, and of Wilson. The idea being that Wilson may have been recruited in the 1950s by the Russians, which was ridiculous. And
it's not so ridiculous. Quite clearly, that it would be in the Russian interest to recruit, you know, rising stars in the Labour movement, wouldn't it?
Well, absolutely, but Wilson was not. Wilson was a left to centre Labour politician. He never had any kind of communist links, which he, you know, you could say various people in the Labour Party in the 50s and 60s, they did. They weren't born, but he hadn't. It all went back to his role as a junior minister in the late 1940s when some British jet engines were sold to the Russians. And there were people who would later accuse him of being an appeaser, of being in with the Russians, etc. And in 1974, some smear sheets were given out to a journalist on the Times and into Private Eye. Private Eye became a conduit for a lot of this stuff, which they denied for a long time, but I did a big piece on showing how it was used, about the jet engines. And they resurrected all this kind of stuff, and they ran it through these little action committees. And eventually, if you do that enough, it gets picked up by the main press, and they start to run these things. And so a lot of what's happening in 74, 75 with Wilson is kind of trying to battle these various campaigns in the press. But on top of that, there are also burglaries, and I have some evidence of how those were carried out. And there were also buggings. And for a long, long time, it was simply dismissed as conspiracy theory. And I went to conferences with intelligence people and intelligence academics who, you know, just laughed at all of this. And then the official history of MI5 came out, and a piece was missing, which the person who wrote that, Christopher Andrew, admitted he wasn't allowed to put in a certain piece. And that certain piece was that bugging equipment was put into number 10 in 1963 post the Profumo affair, and ministers were not told.
But it's echoes of Watergate here, aren't there?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Jonathan Friedland wrote a very good piece about a decade ago in The Guardian saying this is Britain's Watergate. And people just kind of, again, they kind of dismissed it. This is not serious. I spoke to somebody, an intelligence person, who was asked by Peter Wright to bug Wilson. He said he wouldn't do it because it was illegal, but he gave in the name of a person who had a company that did this kind of thing. And Peter Wright approached them. There was a lot going on. There's a lot more still to come out, but it's kind of, you have to keep digging away at it.
Well, look, we're now in the situation where this law was passed 3 years ago or so, which says that it doesn't matter if it's illegal, that actually the security services can just simply break the law. They've got a form of impunity, including murder.
Yes and no. I think that's not really true. One thing, of course, is that MI6 are not supposed to operate domestically. MI5 are the domestic security service, and they are allowed to operate domestically, but they are still subject to the law. And if they are, if you discover that they are carrying out burglaries, that would probably domestically against politicians or whatever, that would bring them down. Similarly, if MI6 are carrying out stuff domestically in this country, that is not on, and that would bring them down. But you have to understand the way that they operate. These are clever people, or were clever people. I'm not sure they're so clever anymore. They operate on the system of plausible deniability, which means an MI6 officer, for instance, never actually recruits the agent who carries out the work. They use a cutout. They recruit an agent, and it might be, I can think of one specific instance, a senior police officer who then runs the agents who carry out the work. So if that person who carries out the work is ever discovered, there is no direct link to the service. And this is plausible deniability. And they do that abroad, and they did that here in the 60s and 70s. All right. MI6,
can I just ask you a bit about the economic background too? Because the 70s were quite torrid, weren't they, in terms of industrial disputes, particularly after Wilson left, actually. And various people we were chatting with the former MP Chris Williamson last week, who was saying that actually this was a major part of it, that Wilson was refusing to play ball with the IMF. Callaghan decided that was okay, and that actually this was part of Britain's economic downfall. So I wonder if you think that came into the attempt to get, because I mean, basically, like he was in the way of British troops going to Vietnam, Wilson was in the way of doing all these deals with the IMF.
I don't think that's quite correct. I think there's something there. I mean, historically, the real problem here is that there was a golden age of the economy, which basically runs from about 53 to 73. And Britain's economy was doing very well, and the working class were doing very well. You know, you had this phrase, the aspiring working class, who were getting good wages, etc., and conditions of work, and it was starting to work out. But France and Germany were doing the same, but their standard of living was higher. There was a secret meeting in the late 1950s which included George Kennedy Young, who, despite being on the right, was very pro-Europe. And this was post-Suez, and Eden called this meeting with his closest advisors and said, what do we do? How do we carry out our economic independent foreign policy? And they had three options. One was to carry on alone, which they all said was impossible, because Suez had shown that you can't do that. Britain isn't, you know, despite what reform or whatever might say, a great power. And we're discovering that now. The second option was to join the European Union, EC as it was then. And they all agreed on that. They said, we can have economic growth, independent policy, if we join with the French and Germans. And one of the reasons for that was that they were getting reports about, because people were starting to go abroad for the first time, and they're getting these reports about people were saying, look, the Germans and French, their standard of living is higher than ours. Which is the same now. You're starting to get these reports about, despite the poor economic performance in Europe, the standard of living is still higher. But they said that would probably be very difficult, as it proved to be, because de Gaulle said, we don't want you because you're still too tied to the Americans. So the third option was we go with the Americans. They thought that was kind of inevitable, but they all said, this is a temporary thing. when Britain gets back on its feet economically, then we'll ditch the Americans and we'll do what we want to do, as it were. So that's what happened. But the economy started to decline in the late 60s. Essentially, I think, because investment levels were simply not the same as in Europe. The Germans in particular invested a great deal of money in their economy, which worked, and ours didn't. And then you had, which I think is the watershed on everything, basically, which was the oil crisis. This changed everything. And from that moment on, the British economic model collapsed and is still collapsing. The wages started to go down. The right saw that the trade unions were pushing for higher wages. And there are a group of industrialists in the UK who are on the right and are very supportive of the right-wing Tories and this group of, you know, conspirators, if we call them that, who oppose the economic model. And they decided essentially to battle the trade unions and to oppose the Wilson economic model, which was a producer's economics, putting the producers first rather than consumption. But that kind of lost out. We ended up with a consumption model, which has proved to be disastrous. Now, inflation, because of the oil crisis, increased dramatically. And it did look like the British economy was in serious trouble. And you get to the point where they consider bringing in the IMF. And that famous moment where Dennis Healey goes off. And he goes to a meeting abroad, and Callaghan says, you know, we have to deal with this, and there's a really big problem. If you read Healey, and I did speak to him, in retrospect, he thought that the assessment of the British economy at that stage was too negative. That, yes, there was a problem, but they could have dealt with it. The Treasury, etc., overestimated the debts and the problems, called in the IMF, and that's where it started. He said, in retrospect, he should have stopped it. But there was they were under a lot of pressure, and there was a big, big debate about this. And I think Wilson was probably the best economist there, knew what was going on. But they were under incredible pressure from industry, from the Treasury, etc. Whether it was a conspiracy with the idea some people have put forward that it was designed to, you know, kind of get the Labour Party by bringing the IMF, I don't think that's clear. I think there was probably people in the Treasury who always, and we see this today, always put the worst gloss on things. And that's what drove it. As I said, Healey, in retrospect, thought they made the wrong decision. But the economy was in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, you also, of course, had the troubles, talking of trouble, that kicked off in the early 70s. Yes. And certainly from what I've read, you may be able to correct me, that the Callaghan, who was going to take over from Wilson, was being fed intelligence by MI5 over what was going on in Northern Ireland that Wilson wasn't privy to because they didn't trust him. And it seems to me that, you know, that whole process was a sort of establishment making sure that the people they want in charge are briefed, whereas the ones they don't want in charge are left out in the cold. I mean, that is the Prime Minister in that case. So I just wonder what you make of that sort of idea that maybe Wilson was one of the last Prime Ministers before the establishment kind of moved in and they've never really left.
I don't agree with that analysis. Part of it, I do. Ireland essentially was Britain's Cuba, as the Americans had. It was problematic. The Labour Party wanted out of Ireland. they thought that it was possible to leave. They there wasn't a thing about, oh, we've got to stay in Ireland, we're going to do this. They were trying to find a way out. And the radical here was Wilson. Wilson did put forward ideas from 72 onwards about withdrawal from Ireland. I don't think the idea that he didn't see the intelligence, whatever, is true at all. He disregarded some of the intelligence. He didn't have any great liking for MI5, which was kind of running intelligence in Northern Ireland. He preferred MI6, and MI6 were talking to the IRA. And he used them as a backdoor conduit to talk to the IRA with the idea that actually they would withdraw and that a deal could be done with the IRA of 74, 75. So that period people were talking. It also made deals with Ireland to swap intelligence, which was hugely controversial. Because if it had been found out that the Irish government was talking to the British Army and the British government, that government would have fallen because of the situation in politics in Ireland. So it was all very delicate. And the reality was that people like Callaghan and Merlin Rees were the ones who didn't get the intelligence, that Wilson himself had access to all this stuff and was playing a very complicated game. Now, Callaghan was on the right of the Labour Party, and he came from a very pro-security, pro-police background, and his ideas were not the same as Wilson. And when it came to Wilson's resignation in 76, Callaghan comes in, and Merlin Rees got really angry because he discovered he hadn't been given intelligence. He did not know some of the things that were going on in Ireland, even though he'd been Northern Ireland Secretary. And some of those things included the smear campaigns, which were partly undertaken, or Colin Wallace had knowledge of them. The information officer in Northern Ireland who would later blow the whistle on all of this. There was a very dirty war going on, both a kind of physical war against the IRA, intelligence, security, killing of informers, plots, and a information war going on, which was used by these elements I've spoken about, and also what was known as the Information Research Department, which was a semi-covert part of the Foreign Office. And someone put together smear sheets, which were about members of the Labour Party and supposed links to communists and all this kind of stuff, which were given to journalists and would find their way out into the media. And also, you know, British intelligence are very good at kind of gossip groups, that they will put something into a group which will eventually spread out through, you know, academics, journalists, clubs, etc. And there was stuff about Wilson, etc., that was kind of put into this arena, and it kind of spreads, and the idea becomes that Wilson is untrustworthy, too clever by half, too close to the Russians, too close to Jewish people, too close to people like Lord Kagan and others, and eventually it's kind of, it wears people down.
I suppose the idea is that you've got groups of people that think that they're getting inside info, and so that it slowly sort of spreads from there. But look, I mean, I think we've got to end on looking at something a bit more up to date. We've had last week, the BBC did quite a good report, I thought, about MI5 lying to the courts here to protect a violent neo-Nazi spy, Daniel de Simone. Yeah. The BBC's investigative correspondent. Now, this is an appalling case. MI5 have been lying. One of their agents of influence is, as you would expect, far right. But they're not really doing any kind of due diligence. This guy's basically a maniac who's extremely violent. And he's been threatening his girlfriend, so-called girlfriend, and saying, I can do anything to you. I can even kill you because MI5 will protect me. So this doesn't sound good, and it certainly doesn't sound good when it ends up in the courts and MI5 just lie about it.
That's what they do. They are perfectly prepared to lie in order to protect knowledge of what they do. They do not want people to find out what they really do, because that's a slippery slope in their eyes. As soon as you start that, they think it will be a disaster. This really goes back, I think, to, well, one is, again, it's this culture of secrecy that, like, there was a, there were two journalists, Penrose and Courtier, who did a book called Pencourt File about the plots against Wilson. Barry Penrose died about 3 years ago, and I spoke to him before he died, and he said, well, you have to remember, and this, we're talking about 1976, 77, we knew nothing about the intelligence services. We didn't know who they were. We didn't know what they did. And it was very difficult to find out anything. So you had this period of post-war where MI5, MI6, there was no scrutiny. The names did not appear in the press. Nobody knew what had happened. And then you had in America the investigations into the CIA. And this horrified people inside the services. And they really worried that this was what was going to happen here. And so they started to close down things. And so, yes, this case is awful, but it's not the only one. I mean, I'm writing a book about Colin Wallace at the moment, and MI5 lie all the time. What's interesting is why people allow this and why people in positions of authority and power allow it to go on. You can read documents now where you have meetings of senior civil servants and, you know, attorney general, whatever, and suddenly everything stops because the MI5 office says, we can't talk about that, and we're not willing to release information about that. And everybody just says, yeah, okay then. Right.
Is it as simple as the fact that, well, we do need the sort of heavy squad, and we don't ask too many questions about them because we know they're on our side?
There's a lot of people go along with that, yeah. But, you know, the scrutiny by Parliament is mediocre. It's controlled by the Prime Minister in the end. And in general, they don't want any real scrutiny of what happens. And so there's the lack of control from the very top of politics. And, of course, you have this kind of ring of secrecy, and you bring people into it, basically, to close them down, I think. In our case, it's the Privy Council, whereby ministers are inducted into it. It's a very interesting and mysterious thing. Tony Benn in his diaries recounts a time when he became a minister and they asked him to join the Privy Council, and they gave him the oath. And he said, I don't want to do this. I've already done an oath when I come into the House of Commons. Why do I need another one? And he complained, and they said, well, you have to, but it doesn't really matter if you're not willing to actually say it. We will just read it out. And then you're a member of the Privy Council and you are tied to its conditions, which is kind of ultra secrecy. And you don't talk about intelligence matters and whatever. And people go along with this. they do it. And it's an extra layer of secrecy in government. And organizations like MI5, MI6 rely on this. And also it gets taken into a kind of convention where you have in the House of Commons and they say, oh, I'm sorry, we don't talk about intelligence matters. And some of this is absurd because you can go back and they actually talk about the SAS and you can find like the London Gazette, which lists all the people in the Foreign Office and Army offices, etc. And you can see if you go back in 50 years, SAS are mentioned when somebody gets a promotion, all that kind of stuff. But now you can't talk about it. And people just think this is the way it's always been. But it's not. These are all conventions. One of the worst ones was when I did my history of MI6. The publishers, Fourth Estate, who were very good, came under a lot of pressure from what's known as the D Notice Committee. And the D Notice Committee it's a semi-official body which kind of oversees the media journalism with regard to defense and intelligence matters. And they have the editors of newspapers on their committee. And if you write about intelligence and you name an officer, they will get on to the editor and suggest that's not really a good idea doing that. We think you shouldn't do that. And most editors will go along with that. Anyway, I came under a lot of pressure and they said, we'd like to see your manuscript and help you so that you won't be breaking any rules or the Official Secrets Act. And I told the publishers, forget it. Have no contact with them at all. And they kept doing this and they contacted me direct and said, oh, Mr. Donald, would you like to come out for lunch? We can discuss these matters. And I said, get lost. But most authors, most publishers go along with this system. And if you don't go along with the system, then they play hardball. And they will say, well, you know, this could be dangerous. You might be breaking the Official Secrets Act. And in my case, the Attorney General wrote a letter saying, we're going to prosecute you under the Official Secrets Act because you've broken the Act. And I said, specifically where? And I knew this would probably happen, so I'd taken precautions. And I said, well, I'm sorry. The pieces you are referring to, I'd already given to a German newspaper. I'd learnt this lesson from Colin Wallace, where you surface some material abroad in some obscure publication, then you can bring it back in here. And I said, it's already been in the public domain, so you can't. But they do this all the time, and a number of authors have had terrible experiences where they've come down hard on them, particularly over Northern Ireland and places. And this is what happens. MI5 will do this and say you can't talk about that, and the media in general goes along with it.
Well, that's extraordinary, Stephen. Can you just run through some of the titles? You mentioned your MI6 book there. If people are interested in following up on this.
Well, I did book with Ron Ramsey, Smear, Wilson and the Secret State. I did one on the intelligence services in the 1990s, The Silent Conspiracy, which I think is a bit hard to get hold of now. My history of post-war MI6 is still out there, which it's interesting. You know, authors have two kind of thoughts about their work. One is they like to see people come forward with stuff because they're interested in the subject. You want to see people come forward with stuff about MI6. On the other hand, you worry that somebody will come forward with stuff and say all your stuff's a load of rubbish. But with regard to it's interesting. My book's 20 years old, but no one really has come forward with a new version. So it's kind of still stands there. And you kind of think this is another problem with what goes on here is that so many different areas where people, authors, publishers fear to tread, and you don't see particularly on the media and the TV, whatever, much nowadays going into depth into any of these areas. And I did a big biography of Sir Oswald Mosey, Blackshirt. And I did, was a few versions of Honey Trap, book about the Profumo Fair. And there's a couple of books on the horizon coming out when I get round to finishing them.
Stephen, I mean, I have to ask you, as someone that's written about MI6, the this obviously came out after the death of Diana in Paris, and I remember at the time this chap Richard Tomlinson, who claimed to be an MI6 officer, he also said that they
had claimed he was
right. Okay, he said that he had been hung out to dry by MI6 in the Yugoslavian conflict by having his cover blown by them. And it looked like MI6 expected him then to be killed because they knew he was a spy when he was trying to work undercover over there. But his own bosses had blown his cover, which is a pretty appalling behaviour. It's the sort of thing that you don't usually expect to see the boss of MI6, telling one of these Dr. No-style agents in the films that Bond is an agent and while he's undercover to get him killed. But he said some interesting things about the Diana death, that he believed that MI6 actually had a plan to kill Slobodan Milosevic. In fact, he swore an affidavit to that effect, a very similar way to the way Diana died. They wanted to kill Milosevic, and he'd actually seen a plan to do this in a tunnel with a bright flash to dazzle the driver, with pursuit riders on high-powered motorbikes, this sort of thing. And so I wonder if you think there's any credibility to that. There's still people around there, out there, that believe that this was simply an MI6 operation.
All this stuff came out about the time of my MI6 book. And I knew that if I had contact with Tomlinson, I would run into a great deal of trouble because they were after him for revealing stuff. And I know that they threatened a major newspaper with the Official Secrets Act and all kinds of things. And some people knew stuff and they closed it all down. So I deliberately avoided Tomlinson. Although, in fact, I can't say how, but I got hold of his information. And he's totally credible because he was an MI6 officer. What happened was that they decided they were going to release him. And he couldn't understand this. And there were no reasons, really. And the way that they did it was terrible. And the backup and what they were going to help and all the rest of it. And he got really, really angry about this. And he kind of threatened to release material. And they didn't do anything. And eventually he did. But also it was because some of the stuff that they were doing was clearly illegal. Now, the Diana stuff, I've got a story about that. It happened when my book was being released, and we were having a celebration for the release of my book, and somebody came in and said, there's a chauffeured car outside from Al Fayed who wants to see you, and would you go to Harrods? Okay, so I went to Harrods and I walked in and there was a major display of my MI6 book in the front of Harrods. And I remember some other authors being very jealous because suddenly there was a big spread. And I got invited to Al Fayed's penthouse, and he said he was actually quite open. He was there with his security guy, former Scotland Yard guy, and said, I've read your book, I really like it, I've read all the stuff, because I put in Tomlinson's material about Diana, and he said, I know you do not believe that there was any conspiracy with regard to the death of Diana, but you've said some interesting things, and we spent a couple of hours talking about that. And at the end, he said, I'm going to give you a present. And he handed me one of his ties. And he said, you'll need this if they come after you. He's referring to MI6. And it was a pull-off tie. He said, if they try and strangle it with the tie, it just pulls off. So we had this discussion, and I said, no, there was no plot, etc. What Tomlinson was saying was, it was factual, that there had been a plan, if they thought it was going to happen, to assassinate Slobodan Milošević. And there were elements of that he could see that she could use to kill somebody in a position like Diana in the tunnel, as you said, with the flashlight. And he revealed that there were senior MI6 officers in Paris at the time, and that one of them was related to Diana's best friend, which I revealed, and was one of the things that the Dino's committee, etc., really disliked. So that's why I'm with Tomlinson. But Tomlinson, they tried to work out a deal with him, which didn't really work out. And then he revealed some names of MI6 officers, most of which actually had already been put into the public domain, partly by me and a few others, beforehand. And then there was a flood of stuff, most of which are inaccurate. So it's a complicated story, but Tomlinson was at the same time, as you may recall, David Shaler. And Shaler, I saw him in Paris, was under intense pressure from MI5 not to talk about things, and he did talk about the assassination attempt in Libya and some details of that, which one newspaper in particular did have, but again they were threatened and so they didn't reveal it, and I got hold of that and did reveal it, and they came after me. There were a couple of things that happened, which they tried, and they kind of behind the scenes put pressure on and try and stop you doing this kind of stuff. But Shayla told me, I do have an MI5 file. He'd seen it and he'd read it. So they do keep tabs on people.
Can you just go into a little bit of detail about the sort of pressure that they can put on you? And the idea surely is to make you think, well, it might not be, it might just be coincidence, something that's happened to you. So what happened to you, if you don't mind talking about that?
I was offered a job, and with the job comes an automatic grant. And I was the only person ever not to get the grant. And I rang up the Home Office and said, what's going on? I haven't got the grant. What's happened? And the woman said, oh, we've looked at your file and decided not to give it to you. And she then put the phone down. And then about 10 minutes later, rang me back and said, I never spoke to you. It's bizarre. There's things like that. And they put pressure on publishers. It's kind of, look, can't we talk about this? We'll take you to lunch. And what we'll do is, if you don't put in that piece of information, we could give you a good story about something else, and we can cooperate. And then, of course, you get drawn into this, and it gets deeper.
Well, I can remember Charles Shoebridge, we interviewed him a few years ago, saying that all of the London national newspapers, TV and radio correspondents, security correspondents, had been drawn in. And that actually they, although they may not realise it, they were effectively working as PR people for the intelligence services. The stories that the intelligence service didn't want to come out didn't come out, and the ones that the intelligence services didn't mind coming out did come out.
I think that's how it works. I mean, it's difficult because I know one or two. Well, I've known quite a few, but I know one or two people have written journalists have written on intelligence who've been completely upfront about what they do. Then get accused of working for the intelligence services, which is untrue. So it's a very, very difficult line to be drawn. The problem is, of course, that if you have like a foreign correspondent who works abroad and has had contact with MI6, for instance, and maybe has run some stories and whatever, and you go say to, you know, Iran, they will immediately think you're actually an MI6 person. So it can be very dangerous. So you have to be really careful about these relationships. The other side of that is, which is problematic, which we mentioned, is that in America, you have some journalists, Seymour Hersh is a prime example, who write about intelligence, and they have really high contacts. They know people. Whereas in this country, there are no journalists who write on intelligence who have those kind of contacts. So, you know, in the past, there have been various scandals, say like Stalker or something. And journalists simply did not have the contacts to be able to really go to town on those. So a lot of things go by the board, and then you are reduced to briefings by intelligence, who obviously they're briefing in their interest. They're not briefing in your interest. So again, it's this kind of ring of secrecy. It's this culture of secrecy that exists and still exists, and it's very hard to break down.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Richard Norton Taylor as you're saying this, because he was someone from The Guardian who definitely did have a bit of an independent bent, and he had a bit of support from The Guardian too to run stories which the intelligence services wouldn't be too happy about. Of course, even though, I mean, he's getting on, he's not able to get anything out through The Guardian anymore because, I mean, there does seem to have been a change in the way that these national newspapers operate, Stephen, doesn't there? They're leaning more towards the establishment and away from the public that read the papers, and maybe that's why trust in the press is declining, or part of the reason.
I think you're correct on that. I mean, I know Richard very well, and I've known him a long time, and I used to talk to him a lot. And he always worried about this because there were people on the left who were saying, oh, he's a spook journalist, which was untrue. He was doing exactly what he's supposed to do. He did have contacts, mostly in the civil service, but... And they spoke, but it was always on a correct kind of level. But he did write very critical stuff. He's always been very critical of the intelligence services. It's that very difficult line. And from the outside, it looks like some people are in bed with the spooks. And sometimes it's simply not true. And you go back to what I said about Barry Penrose, that most journalists don't know. They know very little. We know a lot more than we did. But the other side of this is that, you know, investigative journalism is not in a good state in this country. There is some excellent stuff being done by, you know, Declassified was the example of kind of independent online. But when you come to things like TV, there's nothing. It's just gone. You used to have on ITV, you'd have World in Action, the Yorkshire one as well. There were two or three investigative strands, BBC, Panorama, which is reduced to 30 minutes, popular stuff. I was consultant to two programs on intelligence with Panorama. They weren't brilliant, and they you know, stepped very lightly around the subject, but at least they did them. But that doesn't happen anymore. Channel 4, Secret History, that's kind of gone. So it's very difficult to get this stuff out. And in general, publishing's in a really bad state. I know people who did really great stuff in the 80s, 90s, whatever, simply can't get a book published. Partly because there's no money. You know, if you get an advance for a book now, say on MI6, whatever, your advance is probably 90% less than you would have got in the 1980s or 1990s. How do you do a proper research job on that? You can't. What happens is you'll see dozens of these books, and I'm not exaggerating, there are, whereby a writer will go to the National Archives and get a file from MI5, big fat file, and write a book which is, you know, kind of the spy who won the war, the spy who did the Germans in, etc. There's lots of these books. And all they are MI5 files that are rewritten. Very little original research. And people take what is written in an MI5 file as gospel, as if it's true. I've got a book coming out, which is a biography of an MI5 officer who worked with John le Carré. And he told John le Carré, leave, because it's a waste of time here. This was in the mid-50s. And he told me that he got in touch with me because I'd written the biography of Oswald Mosley. And his job was to monitor the fascists in Britain in the mid-50s. So he went to meetings of Mosley, wrote up the reports, there were special branch people taking notes, wrote up the reports, went back to the office, put them in a file, and he said, what happened? He put the file in another file, and it was never seen again. And he said what he was doing was a waste of time. You know, Mosley in the mid-50s did not pose any kind of threat. But you had to write these files, endless reports from Special Branch and whatever. And nothing happened. It was useless. And that kind of thing has gone on for 50 years.
Is it possible to fix this, do you think? I mean, you mentioned the Privy Council. I don't know if you could...
Get rid of the Privy Council.
Crack that nut. But, sorry, what did you say?
Get rid of the Privy Council.
Is that
feasible? You know, it's been there 500 years. It's time to go. It's used by a shortcut by prime ministers and whatever to get stuff done. But it's not democratic. Get rid of it. Reform the Official Secrets Act. Reduce the size of MI5 and MI6. You know, MI6 is now bigger than at any time since the Second World War. Bigger than it was during the Cold War. It's, you know, one of the things I got, I didn't get so much into trouble. I gave a story to the Financial Times on the funding of MI6. I said, I know from a source that most of the funding of MI6 is hidden, that what goes before Minister's Parliament is not true. And a senior journalist on the Financial Times took it up and did a story about it and said, yeah, it's true. They hide. Some of it is hidden in other departments and some is hidden in the defence budget, which is of interest now because that's becomes more and more important. And he said, I read the story. He said, I've never had so many problems. They really got on to him about this. They were really angry, got on to the editor, got on to him, said, it's totally untrue, and why are you doing this, etc. It's kind of it was the big secret of MI6 that their budget was much bigger than anybody knew. So there's a lot of stuff that's still hidden. I don't see any reason why they regard it as an official secret, the actual size of the budget. I cannot for the life of me see why. The only thing is it's slightly embarrassing because we're such a minor country, really, you know, as is being shown at this moment with the Americans. And they don't want it revealed. You know, 80% of intelligence that MI6 gets comes from the Americans. And I was at a conference with some intelligence people, CIA, and European intelligence people, some British academics. And I said to them, when are you going to create a European intelligence agency? And there was uproar from the British. They said, that's never going to happen. And I said, that's crazy. Of course it's going to happen. If you have a European army, which will be coming, and this was a decade ago, you inevitably have a European intelligence agency. And they were horrified by the prospect because that meant you would be going against the Americans. They did not want to do that. There was a guy from the Dutch intelligence, a guy from German intelligence, and they said, yes, you're right, there will be one, and we're working towards it. You know, British just scared of it.
Yeah, the Privy Council is, I mean, we've come across it in Bristol because we've got a very powerful and very wealthy and very secretive group called the Merchant Venturers. And they seem to sort of basically own the city. They've certainly owned lots of the property. They take a great deal of interest from behind the scenes in the political process in the city. They are the families that financed the trip of John Cabot formed a it's called the Society, but it's constituted under a royal charter. And right. As you start to try and investigate these people, like where their massive shareholdings are, you realise you can't at all because there's no transparency whatever. You can see where they pop up on boards of public, well, what used to be public, now privatised utilities and things like that. But you can find out absolutely nothing about them. The only people that will get involved in regulating something that's formulated under a royal charter is the Privy Council. But this is surely, comes down to King Charles, doesn't it? It's not really something under Starmer's remit at all.
Well, it's because it's allowed. I mean, this is the same as the City of London, isn't it? That it's actually a separate entity and comes under the Privy Council. But this is simply, you know, the Labour Party has never been willing to challenge the role of the royal family. You know, there's a great book, I thought. What's it called? The Enchanted Glass by Tom Nairn, the Scottish nationalist. It's about 20, maybe 30 years old. I mean, two things. One is he wrote a big critique in the early 70s of those on the left who were anti-Europe, anti-EU. And he said, if you go against us joining Europe, what will happen? He said, there will be an election of a right-wing government, and at the time he said, under Enoch Powell, which will be far more right-wing than anything we've got at the moment, and the chances of socialism will never happen. And of course, that turned out true with Brexit. But the other thing he wrote about was that the enchanted glass of the royal family, etc., is put forward as being just an image that they don't have any power. And he said that's just not true, that actually they do, even if it's only symbolic, that there are lots of institutions that are still part of that whole kind of royal matrix, and things like the Privy Council, Lord Lieutenants, City of London. There's lots of things that are still there which are not under normal democratic accountability. You know, In a fantasy life, if I was the Prime Minister, the first thing I would do is order a forensic audit of royal finances. You know, what do we have? All these galleries, pictures, who do they actually belong to? At the end of the day, they belong to the state. But we have this kind of image fantasy of the royal family running this stuff. But it's not really. It's things like the Privy Council and like these unelected bodies that are still there. And if you're really interested in democracy, you know, there should be a political party that comes forward and says, we really need democracy in this country because we haven't got it.
Finally, Stephen, there was a book came out by Chris Mullin called A Very British Coup, going back to Wilson, finally, and actually quite a good film I remember watching a while ago.
It was.
Which was all about a Prime Minister who was being surrounded by enemies and decided he was going to pretend to announce his resignation live on television. But actually, the speech was really just naming and denouncing the conspirators who were trying to get rid of him. And this was, I mean, it's actually a pretty electric film. I wonder whether, to what extent that book and film related to the, you know, the smears and the forcing out of Wilson in 76.
Well, it is a good book. And Chris Mullin, of course, was very active on the left in a number of campaigns. And he was on Ireland, etc. And he was very good. And the book is clearly based on that. Interestingly, I think I've got about three or four books now that are largely based on the Wilson episode. I mean, one of the things interesting I find now is that there's a kind of general view grown up that Wilson went because he thought he was getting Alzheimer's or whatever, was ill. Which I think is basically just another smear, essentially. It was, as we point out in smear and subsequent articles, Wilson had made plain that he would retire when he did retire, that his wife, Mary, had never been happy with him being in politics. She wanted him to be an academic, which he could have been, because he, you know, This is a guy who had the second best ever degree at Oxford. He was extremely clever. He could have been an academic. He went into politics and he told people close to him when he was going to retire, and he did. He was worn out, partly because of what was happening with these various campaigns, but also from the internal politics, which was probably much more intense than is even now within the Labour Party. And he wasn't getting much help from people, such as the BBC, about revealing what was going on. I'd spoken to a number of journalists, and they just couldn't get backing to pursue the story of this campaign against him, and he ended up with Penrose and Courtier, who did a pretty good job, but they came under a lot of pressure at the BBC and others, and the real story that they had was kind of downplayed and wasn't fully revealed. I mean, I spoke to Penrose, and he gave me stuff before he died about other aspects of this and some things that have never been revealed. What happened was the story got sidetracked by Jeremy Thorpe scandal, that the press became obsessed with this story about Jeremy Thorpe and the comic episode of the killing of the dog Rinka. And that became the main topic.
Yeah, well, so this is classic stuff, isn't it? A rabbit hole. Steer everyone down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an important story, and there are elements of it, of course, that are linked to the plotting. There's a South African connection, which, again, has kind of been downplayed, and people say it didn't exist. But that's not quite true either. So a lot of things going on, and it kind of got sidetracked. And Wilson did become ill But that's not the reason for his resignation. He was drinking fairly heavily. But there is now also, which has had some traction, which was a smear story that was put out by this group of extreme right-wing intelligence people, that Wilson went because of one specific story that was about to be launched, which was to do with a burglary and the claim that they got Wilson's tax records, which would have been highly damaging, and that these were shown to Wilson, and that's why he resigned. I've done quite a lot of work on that, and it's a complicated one. The burglary certainly took part, and the tax records certainly were there, but they're not damaging. And there is an aspect of it, which I will reveal at some stage, which shows how deep this kind of campaigning, smearing of Wilson was going. And some of the people involved in it was certainly linked to intelligence. So it gets complicated. But, you know, Wilson's persona, standing has grown, I think, because people realize.
No, I'd agree, yeah. I think there's people, anyone that's familiar with this story and starts to look into it. And actually, I also mentioned the BBC did quite a good dramatization of it with James Bolam. And this, the more you look into this, and I'm quite excited to hear, Stephen, that there's still maybe more to emerge. Anyway, Stephen Dorrell, author of Smear, about the resignation and the smearing of Prime Minister Harold Wilson. That's absolutely fascinating. And I'm sure we'll speak to you again at some point about when you come to reveal a little bit more about this amazing story. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.